This coming February 6th, Ronald Reagan would have celebrated his 100th birthday. To honor him, Ron Reagan decided to learn firsthand about the places, people, and events that shaped the larger-than-life figure that was his dad. The book, My Father at 100, a memoir, is published by Viking and goes on sale today, but it has already generated quite a bit of controversy. And here to discuss his legendary father is Ronald Reagan. Welcome back.
Thank you, Leonard. Good to be here.
Do you remember when your father first became political, or was he always political?
Well, he was certainly political before I arrived, or was sentient anyway. Mm-hmm. I think he made a transition from liberal Democrat to conservative in the late 40s, early 50s. By the time I knew him, he was a conservative Republican.
But it is interesting that there are four kids, mm-hmm. And two would be called liberals and two would be called conservatives.
It's
How did that happen?
Well, I don't know that it's that unusual in a family to have a divide that way politically. The two eldest, my elder sister Maureen and who's deceased now, and Michael were very conservative, almost trying to outdo their dad in conservatism. And Patty and I, my sister Patty and I, just kind of went in a different way. We were children of the 60s, I suppose.
Well, Michael is one of the people who is weighing in on the most divisive revelation in this book, that your father was exhibiting signs of Alzheimer's as early as 1984.
Well, let's be careful about that, because that's not exactly what I said in the
book. Please clear it up.
I know that over the weekend, and I know that Michael has been weighing in on this, it probably would have been better if he'd actually read the book first. What I say in the book is that my father, knowing what we know now about Alzheimer's disease, that it is a process that extends over years, even decades, we are now discovering, before identifiable symptoms arise, that it is therefore kind of an academic question, given when he was diagnosed a few years out of office. It's a virtual certainty that the disease was present while he was in office. I say specifically in the book that I saw no signs of dementia-like symptoms while he was in office. That I had vague notions that a little slowing here and there or something, but nothing that I attributed to Alzheimer's at the time. How could I possibly diagnose him that way? Could have been that he'd been shot and nearly killed. Could have been that he was in his mid-70s, and naturally you slow down a little bit. I had concerns at times, but they were background concerns for the most part.
The only way we can know whether somebody is in the earliest stages of Alzheimer's is if we do a brain scan or something like that.
Exactly, and that wasn't done until he was thrown from a horse after he left office. And when that was done, that was the first time that we had any intimation that Alzheimer's was an issue.
But watching the first debate between your father and Walter Mondale in October 1984, it's hard not to notice that he's forgetful, nervous, mm-hmm. and disoriented. And I don't know, were his aides concerned at the time?
It certainly became a topic of conversation, as I recall. Everybody was talking about, is he too old to be president now? And I was naturally worried about that myself. I was concerned for him. So I determined to go back and be there at the second debate with Walter Mondale and see for myself what was going on. And, of course, in that debate, he, seemed fine. He was his old self and seemed to win the debate and, of course, crushed Mondale in the election.
Well, we all have our good days and our bad
Indeed.
Days. There are some days when every word just comes to me and other days when I have mm-hmm. to struggle. But you write about shadowing him for a day in the White House mm-hmm. to see if there was a problem. And you notice that he rarely conducted phone calls without cue cards.
Yes. Now, it would be well to remember that most presidents are overprepared for phone calls. The aides are always providing them with little, cards and scripts and things like that to make sure that they, know who it is they're talking to, which congressman this is, which, what bill they're interested in, all that kind of stuff. So I did. My concern then was not, his mental state as such. It was that he seemed to be lagging behind in coming to grips with the issue of Iran-Contra. And I wanted to see what was going on for myself and encourage him to get, engage with this and admit what everybody knows now, that this was obviously arms for hostages, which he ultimately did.
So what happened when you talked to him about those things?
I found him initially to be reluctant to engage on that and off his stride. Many people have remarked on this. This is the low point of his presidency, and I think the thing that disturbed him more than anything was the perception by the American public that he had lied to them, that he was being dishonest. He, of course, had convinced himself that the arms initiative, the arms going to Iran, weren't really arms for hostages. I mean, after all, it was going through Israel, and it went to somebody in Iran, and maybe they had influence on Hezbollah in Lebanon, but, you know, there were too many connections to make for it to be literally arms for hostages. Well, you know, in fact, it was, and he came to grips with that eventually.
Well, I don't want to beat this to death, but there's also footage of moments when your mother would step in and finish your father's thoughts.
There was the one instance at the ranch where he was taking questions from the press, and they were shouting at him, and he was hard of hearing by that time. He probably just didn't hear what they were asking, and so she whispered to him, "We're doing the best we can," and he dutifully repeated, "We're doing the best we can." I think that was more that he just couldn't hear what was being shouted, and he was self-conscious about the fact that he was hard of hearing.
When you debated with him over things like Iran-Contra, was he concerned that you were obviously a lot more liberal than he was?
Our debates weren't necessarily about Iran-Contra. That was more a discussion of what's happening here and what do you need to do to, you know, put this behind you.
But you say did debate.
Oh, sure.
Politics,
yeah,
a lot.
Yes. We going back to the Vietnam War, we would argue about that even in my, you know, teenage years. And certainly environmental issues was something that we could, you know, we would disagree about sometimes. My father, I think, had a sort of a 19th century view of nature. He loved to be outdoors. He loved the out-of-doors, being on the back of a horse and out in the woods and all that sort of thing. But I remember riding with him once at Camp David, and a storm had blown through the night before, and there was windfall on the ground, branches that had broken off of trees and were, you know, laying out there in the woods. And as we passed a pile of brush, he turns to me and he says, "Well, that may be nature to some people, but I think we can do better."
Did he become interested in things like riding horses because of the movie career? I mean, he grew up...
No, he began riding horses at Lowell Park when he was a lifeguard there, as I discovered. I didn't realize this, but the Walgren family owned horses. They were Big Dixon family, and he would ride some of their horses sometimes.
I mentioned that you actually went and investigated your father's life, you calling mm-hmm. this book a memoir. Mm-hmm. That's because there was a lot of stuff that you didn't know? Were these things not discussed? Was the family history not discussed over the dinner table?
A lot of family history was not. I discovered, for instance, that he had two aunts and an uncle on his father's side that I had no idea ever existed, and my mother never knew existed. We're not sure that my father actually knew that he had these people, although the uncle, two aunts died early, but the uncle died when he was a teenager in an insane asylum in Dixon, Illinois. He was committed there with a diagnosis of alcoholic psychosis and died there. So it's kind of hard to believe that my father wouldn't be aware of him, but I don't know.
But there's also a feeling that your father, as warm as he came across, was rather withholding and might not have or have felt that there were certain things that shouldn't be talked about.
Possibly. I use the metaphor of, you know, 90% and 10%. The 90% of them is right out there, and what you see is what you get. But for all of us that were close to him, we realized that there was this part of him, this 10%, if you will, that he held very close and that was very private. He was by nature a very solitary man, paradoxically, a solitary man who was quite comfortable in public.
Maybe that's why he was so effective as an actor.
Perhaps.
Because actors often are people who feel more comfortable actually being in being somebody else.
Yes, my impression of him is that he was always playing the same character. He was always playing a version of himself, and that version is the hero.
Well, that was the way Hollywood was when he came into films. John Wayne was always – when John Wayne – played a difficult person in The Searchers, people mm-hmm. were stunned
yes.
that he actually could be somebody other than John Wayne.
Yeah. I don't think it was really about movies and acting so much with my father. I think that is how he saw himself moving through life. He, you know, let's remember, as a teenager and a young man, he was a hero in Dixon. He saved 77 people, pulling him out of a river. I've seen that river. It was a real river. You know, you'd have to work to get somebody out of the middle of that river.
Mm. Well, you say that although there were things you didn't know, people would come up to you all the time and tell you Yes. About him.
Yes.
What was that like, where people seemed to know more about your father than you knew?
Oh, indeed. I mean, there are many people, of course, who know more about the specifics of his political career or his policy initiatives than I do, people who worked with him in the White House. But yeah, for my entire life, it's just one of the strange things about having a parent who is so well known. People do come up to you and they want to tell you about your father. You know, well, let me tell you about the time he this or that. And sometimes it's very interesting because you learn things you didn't know. Sometimes it feels a little odd that somebody is actually telling you about someone you know very well.
My guess is Ron Reagan. And you call yourself Ron Reagan because it would be very confusing otherwise?
Yes. I mean, I've gone by Ron since I was about seven, I think. So.
His latest book, My Father at 100, a memoir published by Viking. On Good Morning America, you said that you knew that people would want to know what your mother thinks of your book. So
yeah.
What did she say after she'd read it?
Well, particularly when the whole flap began over the weekend about this, I called her yesterday and said, you know, people are going to ask me what if you've read it and what you think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so what should I tell them? She said, tell them that I read it, I loved it, it made me cry, and I'm very proud of you. Which is a very mom kind of thing to say, of course.
On the other hand, you probably expected Michael to have the reaction that he had.
Honestly, I'd never given it a thought as to what Michael would say.
You weren't close. You were half brothers, but
yeah, we're not particularly close. I don't know if it was his intention, but he's probably helping me sell books at this point.
And Patty, has she read it?
I don't know. I'm not aware that she has. Or has it, for that matter.
Well, your father is this mythological figure in the Republican Party, invoked by everyone, Glenn Beck, Sarah Palin, Rush Limbaugh, and every Republican in Congress. What would your father think of being brought up every time there is a partisan debate?
Well, he'd probably be a little bit flattered that his name was still on everybody's lips.
Well, was he alive when people suggested that his face be put on Mount Rushmore?
Boy, I can't remember. He may have been alive, but I don't know that he was really aware that, you know, that was going on. That might have been going a little too far for him. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a genuinely modest person, and, you know, he liked the accolades, but, yeah, I don't think he would have wanted somebody else's head to be chipped off the mountain and his put on. I don't know about that. People wonder what he would think about politics today. What would he think about Barack Obama? What would he think about the Tea Party? What would he think about Sarah Palin? And I don't know. I can't speak for my father. And that, you know, he left public life 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's a long time. Things have changed.
Well, obviously, the recent assassination attempt on Representative Gabriel Giffords must have stirred some memories for you. And we have a clip of your father talking about the attempt on his life with Larry King.
I heard a noise, and we came out of the hotel and headed for the limousine, and I heard some noise, and I thought it was firecrackers. And the next thing I knew, one of the Secret Service agents behind me just seized me here by the waist and plunged me headfirst into the limo. I landed on the seat, and the seat divider was down, and then he dived in on top of me, which is part of their procedure to make sure that I'm covered. Well, as it turned out later, the shot that got me caromed off the side of the limousine and hit me while I was diving into the car. And it hit me back here under the arm and then hit a rib, and that's what caused an extreme pain. And then it tumbled, it turned instead of edgewise and went tumbling down to within an inch of my heart.
An inch of his heart? Does that mean that his life would have been in danger?
Oh, his life was definitely in danger. We weren't aware immediately just how close he came to dying, but he did. It was touch and go.
Well, at this point, he seems to have been totally aware of everything that was happening at the time.
Yeah, well, he was telling jokes, as we know. And journalist Del Wilbur, who's writing a book about the assassination, shared with me something that I hadn't known. His famous quip about, "I hope you're all Republicans here," to the surgeons. That wasn't the first time he used it that day. He tried it on the emergency room personnel first, but they were too frantic, you know, cutting his clothes off and looking for an entry wound. They didn't react to it. So he figured it's a pretty good line. I'll save it up for another audience. And he waited till he was being wheeled into surgery and tried it again.
But and when he didn't get a laugh, he did try other material.
Yeah, well, he saved that line up. He thought it was pretty good. These people obviously just aren't paying attention. So I'll wait till I've got an audience that's looking at me, and then I'll roll this one out again.
Well, some people might forget just how funny your father could be. We have another clip of your father telling jokes in a press briefing.
You're asking a hypothetical question, and I found out that I never get in trouble if I don't answer one of those. So, never, Sam.
Mr. President, in talking about the continuing recession tonight, you have blamed mistakes of the past, and you blamed the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
He and Sam used to go at each other all the time.
But that was quick. I don't know whether he'd ever used that line before.
No, he was, you know, listening to that second Mondale debate with his line about, I won't make an issue of my opponent's youth and inexperience. That was totally ad-libbed. He couldn't believe that.
That's when his
actually
age was brought up. He said, I won't hold his youth and inexperience against him if he doesn't hold my age against me.
Yeah, yeah.
Very witty.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a witty guy. He was a quick guy.
And that was something that you were aware of when you were growing up?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. No, he was a very intelligent man. I mean, the knock on him from, you know, Washington types and wonky types is always, just an actor, kind of a dimwit, all that sort of thing. He had a very keen intelligence, but it wasn't the type of intelligence that you often see in Washington, D.C., a kind of wonky, clever intelligence. He had a more, you know, mellow wisdom kind of intelligence, more people kind of intelligence than you often see there.
Did you talk about the assassination attempt with him?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What did you get a sense of how it affected him and the way he viewed life?
Well, he began to feel that he had been spared. He was a very religious man, and so he felt that, well, you know, God has spared me. Here. I've been spared in order that I do good in the world. He didn't think that, well, he spared me because I'm such a special guy and now I have God's mandate or anything like that.
But he also didn't ask whether God allowed him to be shot.
that's true. You're talking to an atheist. So, yes, we can go down that road too. But to him, it was, you know, a sign of providence. But he saw that as a responsibility. Now my life is given over to others, essentially.
And do you think it affected the way he approached the presidency afterward?
That I couldn't say. I mean, anything that has a profound impact on you personally must, you know, seep out into everything you do, I suppose. But I couldn't name a way in which it affected him, his policies or anything.
Some people have blamed the shooting of Representative Giffords on a growing incivility when political differences are being discussed. What do you think your father would think about? I know conjecture is always difficult here, but did he talk about what happened when people did engage in name-calling in political debates?
Well, he was always a very civil man. He was a gentleman. He would be, I think, very distressed by the level of invective now, the insults lobbed at the president and just the general tone of some of the debate now. You know, he was famously the 11th commandment about, you know, don't speak ill of another Republican and all that sort of thing. But he just, you know, he wasn't a mean-spirited man. He really thought that he was there to do good for the country, not just to kind of win for the Republicans or anything like that. And, you know, he was quite willing to sit down with people and negotiate and compromise where he had to move things forward.
And people actually citing that, Democrats are citing that today when we reach the kinds of impasses that we have reached recently.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. I mean, you know, at one time there were adults in Congress who could sit down and actually have a discussion and recognize that we can't just sit here bashing each other and not doing anything. We've got to do something. The country has to move. The country can't sit still. But now I think we have a Republican Party, at least some of them, who really they're rooting for failure. They want Obama to fail, and if that means the country has to fail for another 2 to 4 years, whatever it is, well, that's fine with them.
Well, you've been a broadcaster on Air America, for example. Yeah. Do you engage in the same sorts of things? Because right now, when Democrats point out that there have been some pretty hateful things said on some of the conservative talk shows, then conservatives come up with things that liberals have said.
That's right. They go back to the archives and they dredge up somebody somewhere sometime who has said something inflammatory. You cannot blame the shooting of Gabrielle Giffords on Sarah Palin or some particular thing that was said. But, you know, she herself recognized that actions and words have consequences. And the level of invective, when you marry it to a rather cavalier attitude towards mental health and a ready availability of very powerful weapons to anybody, even someone who's pretty obviously mentally ill, can go in and buy a Glock and a, 30-round clip, you've essentially got a machine gun in your hands then.
Almost every attempt on a politician's life has been by somebody who was really looking for some notoriety rather than somebody who had a strong political viewpoint.
Yes, that's true. And often is not somebody who's mentally unbalanced, even if they also had a political point, but, not in their right mind.
On the other hand, it's people are talking again about gun control and pretty much the end of every article I've read is, but unlikely to change. Mm-hmm. The situation's unlikely to change.
It's as unlikely to change as us doing something about global warming.
After your father was shot, did people talk about changing some of the laws?
Well, the Brady Bill passed, and we had the assault gun assault rifle ban. And
people forget
that
the Brady Bill was actually during the Reagan administration.
That's right. James Brady, of course, his press secretary, who was shot in the head and nearly killed there. That personalized it, certainly, for my father. He wasn't going to battle the the Brady Bill, because of that.
But the NRA didn't have the kind of power then that it has today.
Apparently not. They were still powerful, but now they seem to be able to just, give orders on Capitol Hill.
You reveal that your father could be rather competitive with you athletically.
Yes.
Now, he was much older than you.
Yes, he was 47 when I was born, but a very athletic man, a big, strong man. And we used to, from the time I was very small, we would have swimming races, let's say. And he explained to me once that why he wasn't going to let me win. He said, one day you're going to beat me. But when you do, I want you to know that you really did beat me. I don't want you to think, Dad lets me win, so, maybe this doesn't count. And I think I ended up beating him up and down the pool a little sooner than he thought I would. I was 12 or so. But he was competitive, but in a good-natured way.
Well, you also somebody who was very much into physical things.
Yes, yes.
Later you became a dancer. What happened when he decided to pursue an acting career in Hollywood? What did his parents think?
Oh, I think his parents were thrilled, really. I think they were so proud that he had, left the narrow confines of North Central Illinois and had ventured out and made something of him. And that was a different kind of heroism on his part. And I think he was conscious of it. One of the first things he did when he got a studio contract was buy his parents a house. It was the first house they ever held a mortgage on. They'd rented their whole lives, and they brought him out to Hollywood and bought him a house. And, his father died not long after that, but his mother lived there for years until she eventually developed Alzheimer's herself. They were proud.
So Alzheimer's was something in the family.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it was.
In some ways, you have, like your father, you've blazed a trail, an individual trail for yourself. You were at Yale when you decided to leave and pursue a career as a professional ballet dancer. How did your parents react to that?
They were a little surprised, I think.
Didn't they know that you liked to dance?
They did, but I don't think they thought that it was going to go that far. But they were very helpful. They didn't say no. Absolutely not.
Well, there was show business, and your parents were in show business.
Absolutely, yeah. And my father, the only thing they insisted on was that I don't go straight to New York, that I come back to Los Angeles, which turned out to be a good idea. My father then gets on the phone with Gene Kelly, a friend of his, and says, where's the best place for my boy to study when he's in? And Gene tells him, and he was right. happened to be the Stanley Holden Dance Center, was the place in Los Angeles. An old character dancer with a Royal Ballet in London had set up a school, excellent school. All the best dancers when they were in town came through. That was the best place for me. And, you know, from there I ended up back in New York, of course, with the Joffrey.
And the Joffrey then left New York.
They did. Yeah, I was gone by then.
Are you sad about what's happened to dance and why the Joffrey just couldn't keep itself going?
Well, it was always struggling, even when I was, you know, a ballet dancer, and that was kind of the heyday of Mikhail Baryshnikov and, you know, Natalia Makarova and all of that. So ballet was kind of on a high, but even then it struggled. I mean, it's like any of those big production kind of arts, a symphony or opera or anything, it takes a lot of money, and, you know, there's just not a lot of money there.
Because
I know we weren't getting much of it as dancers.
But dancers never get a lot of money.
God, that's for sure.
And even the most successful dance companies rarely can stay together for very long. Only if Twyla Tharp has had to dissolve at least 10 or 15 over the years because she just couldn't keep them going financially.
Yeah. I mean, we've got American Ballet Theater, New York City Ballet, of course, that are perennial. But, it's a struggle. It's a struggle.
Because you decided to become a dancer, people immediately assumed that you were gay. Because I guess, how did your parents react to that?
I think they were a little nonplussed. I think that kind of took them aback a little bit. One of the ironies, of course, was that some of the people who were insisting I must be gay because I'm a ballet dancer were gay activists themselves. And I thought, that's a kind of ironic stereotyping for you to be engaging in, isn't it?
Well, I guess they wanted to use you against your father things he had said about gay rights.
And in particular, Larry Kramer, of course, wanting to use me against my father to advance the AIDS issue, which I understand where he's coming from, but he went about it in a rather odd way, I think.
A lot of attention is paid to presidential children. We saw that with the Bush girls, and we're seeing it now with Clinton. Chelsea, and now with the Obama kids.
Yeah.
Were you and Patty older?
Yes, yes. I was 22 when he was elected president. Patty's 6 years older than I am. Not like Malia and Sasha or Chelsea Clinton, who was, you know, a child, really.
But it would have been different if you had been younger. It's still, it does shock me sometimes that those kids are living under a microscope the way they are.
And it's terribly unfair. I mean, particularly when you are talking about children. I mean, unfortunate things were said about Chelsea Clinton, for instance, didn't John McCain say something at one time?
Yes.
Or something? You know, I mean, honestly, this you're talking about a child, for God's sake. You know, you don't do that.
And it was unfair on top of it all. She's a fairly attractive young woman. But even if she
were lovely, and you just don't do that.
That's... So what led you to give up dancing?
Well, I looked around one day. I was in the middle, actually, of a New York season with the Joffrey. It was my first. And I thought, you know, I can just see my future here. And I'm looking at the older dancers, none of whom are making more than, you know, maybe $30,000 a year. Of course, your body's starting to break down after that. And I thought, you know.
And then they need operations.
Yeah, you know. And I thought.
Knee replacement.
Yeah, exactly. Hips, all kinds of stuff. And I thought, you know, I can do this. I'm good at it. But I don't know if I want to be 35 years old, going on 40 with no prospects other than teaching ballets in some little school somewhere. So I thought, let's get out now. Let's just make a clean breast of it.
And immediately went into becoming a political commentator?
No, not really. I wrote a little for some magazines and eventually ended up on Saturday Night Live guest hosting it. And that opened up some opportunities in television for me, which I had sort of done as a kind of sideline, but it has a way of taking over, and so I ended up doing some TV shows and things.
And MSNBC?
MSNBC, yes, Connected Coast to Coast. That was a show we would do. And the political commentary, and then radio, Air America.
Yeah. Ron Reagan will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 at the Bookend Store in Ridgewood, New Jersey. That's at 211 East Ridgewood Avenue. The book is called My Father at 100, a memoir. And it is published by Viking. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you for having me, Leonard. Appreciate it.